The headlines this hour. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement hails the role of resistance in confronting threats from Israel, which he calls a racist and apartheid entity. Iran's top security official likens the 2015 agreement to an empty shell, ruling out any talks beyond the JCPOA due to Washington's non-compliance and Europe's inaction. And in the UK, victims of a government-backed Islamophobic purge in Muslim-majority schools renew their demands for justice. We'll have a report from Birmingham. Thanks for joining us. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement hails resistance groups for defending the country in the face of Israel's military attacks and threats over the past decades.
The resistance, with all its factions, including Hezbollah, is what preserved the identity of Lebanon, the identity of Lebanon that was going to be erased completely with the invasion of 1982. Every single person who comes and questions the identity of Lebanon today should remember in 1982, in the year 2000, in 2006, and until today, it is the resistance that preserved the identity of Lebanon. It preserved it with blood, with sacrifice, with fighting and struggle and jihad, and it continues to preserve it until today.
The Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah was speaking in a ceremony commemorating the martyrs of resistance. He denounced Israel as a racist and apartheid entity, saying the regime is on the decline. Nasrallah also touched upon Hezbollah's military capabilities. He said the movement has been producing drones in Lebanon and has the ability to turn thousands of rockets into precision-guided missiles. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says the U.S. and Europe have failed in their fulfilling obligations regarding the 2015 Iran deal. In a tweet, Ali Shamkhani said because of such inaction, the deal has already turned into an empty shell for Iran, both in terms of the economic benefits and the removal of sanctions. The top official said there will be no negotiations beyond the deal with a non-compliant Washington and a passive Europe. Currently, Iran and the remaining signatories are engaged in intensive talks in Vienna to revive the accord. Iran is demanding a verifiable removal of sanctions, as well as guarantees that the deal will last beyond the current U.S. administration. Advisors to Iran's negotiating team in the Vienna talks, Mohammad Mirandi, says no matter who's in charge in Washington, U.S. policies indicate that it is an unreliable partner in any talks.
The United States can't be trusted, nor can the Europeans be trusted, because we've seen that the Europeans do whatever the United States tells them to do, whether it's Obama when he warns financial institutions, insurance companies, shipping companies, major investment corporations not to deal with Iran. That was a violation of the nuclear deal, and the Europeans went along with it. When Trump tore up the deal, the Europeans nagged about it, but they went along with it. Under Biden, the Europeans continue to pursue Trumpian maximum pressure sanctions. We have to keep in mind that as we speak, maximum pressure sanctions against women and children continue to be implemented both by the Europeans and the Americans. So under such circumstances, there's no reason for anyone in Iran to trust the Europeans or the Americans about their nuclear commitments, about their commitments to the nuclear deal, nor can the Iranians trust them about with regards to any other form of negotiations when the Europeans and the Americans are seen as unreliable partners within the JCPOA. Then how can other issues that go beyond the nuclear program be discussed with these countries in the hope that an agreement would be respected by the Europeans and the Americans?
The Israeli Prime Minister's visit to Bahrain has caused a lot of outrage there, prompting many people to turn out and make their opposition heard.
Israel!
The protesters marched through the streets of the capital, Manama, chanted slogans against the Israeli regime and in support of Palestine. They also burnt the Israeli flag. Naftali Bennett's short trip to Manama marks the first such visit by an Israeli leader to Bahrain. Bennett met with Bahrain's King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa and the Prime Minister, Crown Prince Salman bin Hamad Al Khalifa. The Israeli Prime Minister's trip coincided with the 11th anniversary of Bahraini's uprising against the Al Khalifa rulers. Bahrain normalized ties with Israel last year under a U.S. brokered deal. The senior official of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement condemns Bahrain for hosting the Israeli Prime Minister, saying that the kingdom is betraying its own people. Sheikh Naim Qassam, Hezbollah's deputy secretary general, says Bahraini officials are wrong if they think their ties with the Israeli regime allow them to keep oppressing their own people. He says the Al-Khalifa regime has committed a historic crime by normalizing ties with Israel. Sheikh Qassam added that Israel will only take advantage of such rulers and leave them powerless in the end. He said that Bahrain and other Arab countries that have recognized the regime will soon find out that they have lost in every aspect. Bahraini activist and political analyst Saeed Shahabi says that the people in the kingdom have been against any ties with Israel since the very beginning.
This outrage has been there since the regime went ahead with the naturalization process with the Israeli regime last year or the year before. Because the people have always been supportive of Palestine, the rights of the Palestinians. They have always been against the idea of occupation. No one in this world has the right to occupy the land of others. Occupation is evil. Even the United Nations until today considers the occupation of East Jerusalem and other places as invalid and illegal. So when the Prime Minister of Israel visited Bahrain yesterday and the day before, it was a cause for outrage among the people. It is just as if you are hitting the people in their hearts with this visit, because it runs against the grains of the feelings and the political inclination of the people.
A leading humanitarian organization calls on U.S. and European leaders to reset their policies on Afghanistan to ease the humanitarian crisis there. New York-based International Rescue Committee warns that the current crisis in Afghanistan could lead to more deaths than the country endured following the U.S.-led invasion in 2001. It says humanitarian needs in the country have skyrocketed since the Taliban takeover. The committee underlines that 97% of the population is expected to be living well below the poverty line by the second half of this year. The IRC, blames drastic international aid cuts and assets freeze as reasons. Several Western countries have stopped giving financial assistance to Afghanistan. A recent U.S. decision to seize half of Afghan frozen funds is expected to make the situation worse. On Tuesday, Afghans took to the streets of the capital, Kabul, to protest Washington's decision. A number of British Muslim teaching staff are demanding a new public inquiry after an investigative podcast revealed that government ministers may have fueled an Islamophobic purge based on a fabricated extremism plot. The notorious Trojan Horse affair rocked Britain back in the year 2014 and led the way for the hostile anti-Muslim climate which affects ordinary British Muslims today. Rob Carter headed to Birmingham to speak to the victims of what's now called a witch hunt.
British Muslim victims of a government crackdown on Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham have issued fresh demands for justice after a new investigation revealed that the government may have acted against them based on bogus extremism threat claims. A podcast series published by the New York Times titled The Trojan Horse Affair alleges that numerous players, including Government Minister Michael Gove, penalised several schools and their staff, despite knowing the accusations weren't credible.
Knowing all of these facts and background, he went on to launch an offensive against our schools and brought down what were, you know, highly successful schools within a matter of months. This was a clear abuse of authority and abuse of power, for which I think that people should be held to account.
The Trojan Horse affair began in 2014 after a mysterious letter was sent anonymously to Birmingham Council. The letter outlined a supposed plot by Muslim extremists to infiltrate, take over, and radicalize schools. On the back of the letter, inquiries were launched, followed by an Islamophobic media frenzy, which then led to several Muslim teachers being sacked or banned from their work.
What we observed and we witnessed this firsthand was institutional racism, institutional corruption, and institutional Islamophobia. The media had a social responsibility to ensure that there was a balance and a reporting of facts. But this was not the case.
Speaking to Press TV, the Muslims targeted say they are victims of a state-backed witch hunt and that the extremism accusations were devastating.
I was unable to get any job. I was even refused voluntary posts. People wouldn't even accept my voluntary work because my name and personality had been stigmatized, I've been vilified, and the label of extremism and radicalism had been attached to my name. So it made me unemployable, quite frankly.
I would also say to Michael Gove, damages and compensation are due, and my ban and the ban of my fellow colleagues need to be lifted immediately.
After spending the day here in Birmingham, it's very clear that the negative effects that the Trojan Horse affair has had on the Muslim community still resonates very strongly. And with the victims' hunger for justice as strong now as it's ever been, the question is, what will be done to hold those who did any wrongdoing during the affair to account going forward? Robert Carter, Birmingham.
While the protests launched by truckers in Canada known as the Freedom Convoy may have subsided, protesters are still out there, forcing Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to have taken an unprecedented move. The Premier enacted an emergency COVID-related order usually associated with national security issues. However, there has been a contagion effect, with protests now spreading to other parts of the world, including the U.S., New Zealand, Australia, and to France.
The government of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is in trouble. His cabinet has invoked a rarely used emergency ordinance to quell anti-vaccine truck protests that have crippled the country. The Emergency Act can authorize the use of the military. It can also temporarily suspend citizens' rights to free movement or assembly, and the government is taking steps to stop financial support of illegal protests. The measure allows Canadian banks to freeze accounts suspected of funding the blockades and suspend insurance on vehicles in the protests. Trudeau has noted that the measures will be time-limited, geographically targeted, as well as reasonable and proportionate. The Canadian law, which was passed in 1988, says, for the purpose of this act, a national emergency is an urgent and critical situation of a temporary nature that cannot be effectively dealt with under any other law of Canada. Trudeau said, the government is not overriding the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, nor limiting the right to peaceful assembly.
The federal government has invoked the Emergency Act to supplement provincial and territorial capacity to address the blockades and occupations.
The plan has drawn widespread condemnation from Canadians, including the Premier in Quebec, Francis Legault, who said Trudeau's announcements risk putting oil on the fire. The trouble all began after thousands of protesters in trucks and other vehicles blocked the streets of Ottawa, as well as two border crossings with the U.S. to vent their frustration over COVID-19 vaccine mandates. The protests have not stayed in Canada, though. Similar Freedom Convoy protests have grown in countries like the U.S., France, New Zealand, Australia. As common with protests, many have also vented their anger against the government due to their economic situation as a result of COVID-19.
Spontaneous thing where people are upset. That's one whole part of this, and it's part of a general movement, I think, that we're seeing around the world of the ultra-right asserting itself and using the money of the millionaires to do it.
The Freedom Convoy protests are not just about COVID-19 restrictions, like lockdowns or cross-border checks. The anger is due to the impact of these laws. They have hindered, slowed down, or in many cases have blocked the workflow, especially when it comes to supply chains. But this has on many occasions led to a loss of revenue.
The so-called Freedom Convoy protest started with truckers protesting COVID-19 vaccine or quarantine mandate. It then broadened to include people opposing all coronavirus-related restrictions announced by the Trudeau government. The protest has attracted the support of thousands of Canadians, even some who are fully vaccinated. They say all COVID-19 preventive measures must be dropped. The protests have drawn support from groups from the U.S.
Jabbing is a right-wing attack on all kinds of things, because one of the demands of the people in Canada was that Trudeau should resign, and the other was that the western part of the country should secede. So, you know, these are not just little political things. So you have, in Canada in particular, the implementation of a very conservative right-wing agenda. And everybody agrees on that, especially the right-wing who's doing it. So this isn't just some kind of, you know, spontaneous thing where people are upset.
Canadian authorities have said about half of the funding for the protests has come from U.S. supporters. Toronto Dominion Bank last week froze two personal bank accounts that received $1.4 million Canadian dollars for the protests. In the western Canadian province of Alberta, police have broke up a group that was armed and prepared to use violence. The protests that have hindered traffic at border crossings have impacted more than $500 million in commerce each day.
I think that what happened was that the automobile companies complained. You know, there's production shut down, millions of dollars lost. And it was pretty clear that that was very unpopular. And he waited long enough for the economy to be heard and people to be heard and said, enough's enough. And I think the balance of force has changed a bit because of that.
Truckers and their supporters have gathered in the capital, Ottawa, since January 29th to rally against mask mandates, lockdowns, restrictions on gatherings, and other COVID-19 preventive measures. Some downtown Ottawa businesses have had to shut down temporarily. There have been reports of rock throwing, property damage, harassment, and even hate crimes.
And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
Murat Kurnaz is a Turkish citizen born and raised in Bremen, Germany, who says he had travelled to Lahore, Pakistan to study the Holy Quran at a Pakistani school, was handed over to the US even though he had no ties to Al-Qaeda, nor had he visited a terrorist camp. He spent 1,600 days enduring various forms of torture at the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. We have prepared for you an article written by Philip Alterman. The piece is titled, Mother of Guantanamo Detainees Still Waiting for U.S. and German Apologies. The mother of a German-born Guantanamo Bay detainee held at the camp for 6 years and tortured has said she is still waiting for an apology or compensation as a new film sheds light on a story she says remains an open wound. In Rabia Gurnaz vs. George W. Bush, which premiered at the Berlin Film Festival on Saturday, 12th of February, the director Andreas Dresen, whose socially engaging filmmaking has led him to be described as Germany's answer to Ken Loach, revisits the case of Murat Gurnaz, who was arrested without explanation in Pakistan in October of 2001, just a month after the suspicious 9/11 attacks. Murat Gurnaz, a Turkish citizen born and raised in Bremen, Germany, who says he had travelled to Lahore, Pakistan to study the Holy Quran at a school affiliated with the Tablighi Jamaat missionary movement, was handed over to the United States, even though he had no ties to Al-Qaeda, nor had he visited a terrorist camp. He spent 1,600 days enduring various forms of torture at the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Gurnaz plays a walk-on part in the film, but its focus is on the story of his mother, Rabia Gurnaz, played by the comedian Meltem Kaptan, and Bernhard Docker, Alexander Scheer, the lawyer she won over to fight for her son's release. Aided by the British actor and activist Vanessa Redgrave, Gurnaz became one of the prominent faces of a class action lawsuit in the United States that eventually won her son the right to legal representation from the U.S. Supreme Court. 15 years after Gurnaz was reunited with her son in August of 2006, her lawyer has said the blame for his client's miscarriage still lies above all with the United States. Bernhard Docker told The Guardian in an interview, President George W. Bush set up an offshore legal vacuum in the Caribbean and destroyed all the procedural safeguards the Western world has known since the Age of Enlightenment. Prisoners at Guantanamo Bay were held as enemy combatants. Bernhard Docker said, they were treated like outlaws in the Middle Ages, adding, because they rejected our laws, the argument went, they did not deserve the protection of our legal system either. 39 prisoners remain in the camp more than 20 years after it first opened. Rabia Gurnaz, however, also places blame for her son's ordeal with a country she has lived in since she was 14 years old. She told The Guardian, I hold the German government responsible for what happened to my son, adding, they should have acted more quickly. After all, Murat was born here. Three German intelligence agents interrogated Gurnaz at Guantanamo Bay a year into his detention and came to the conclusion he was innocent and did not pose a threat to national security. According to cables cited by the news magazine Der Spiegel, neither the Pentagon nor the CIA objected to the idea of releasing Murat Gurnaz to Germany. But the Social Democrat Green German government in power at the time did not act, and the then 20-year-old Murat Gurnaz continued to be subjected to torture at Guantanamo Bay. Bernhard Docker said, instead of using that chance for a humanitarian act to help Murat Gurnaz escape torture and give him a fair trial, Germany rejected the US offer and withdrew his rights to residency and return. Docker added, Germany wasn't responsible for Murat Gurnaz's torture, but it was responsible for his malady lasting a lot longer than it should have. This guilt has not been recognized in any way. Frank-Walter Steinmeier, re-elected as Germany's largely ceremonial president recently, was chief of staff at the German Chancellery at the time, and thus tasked with coordinating ties between the country's domestic and foreign intelligence agencies. According to Der Spiegel, Berlin conveyed to Washington in November of 2002 its express wish that Murat Gurnaz would not be returned to Germany. In 2007, Frank-Walter Steinmeier denied there had been an official offer from the United States, while stating it was right to consider the Guantanamo detainee a security risk at the time. Bernard Docker said, "Steinmeier has a dark stain on his conscience, and he doesn't have the decency to admit it. As president, you're meant to have moral authority, and in my view, he's not up to that job if he doesn't correct the mistakes of the past." It was quick to rediscover Kurnaz as one of its citizens after he returned to Germany. Bernhard Docker said one day after he had returned to Bremen, there was a letter from the Turkish consulate reprimanding him for not doing his obligatory military service. Rabie Kurnaz versus George W. Bush gains comic mileage by playing up the cultural differences between the housewife-lawyer pair from northern Germany. Bernhard Docker zips between court dates on a rusty old bike, while Kurnaz roars around Bremen in a white Mercedes Benz, her tires screeching. Her character tells a friend in the film, "The Germans are smart but slow. You know the saying, start it like a Turk, but finish it like a German." In real life, the pair said they were less of a study in contrast, Docker's law firm a bit less provincial and with more expertise in the US justice system, and Kurnaz's apartment a bit more tidy. However, they both confirm one of the film's best comic moments was real. After Murat Kurnaz's return to Germany had eventually been secured, his mother and lawyer were to announce their triumph at a press conference. But with minutes to go, Rabie Kurnaz was nowhere to be found. Her mission on the global stage complete, she had reassumed her maternal role and gone shopping to find new clothes for her son instead. Bernard Docker said, "We were so annoyed at the time, but afterwards we couldn't stop laughing." Murat Kurnaz, who now works with young people as a social worker at an outdoor sports center in Bremen, Germany, had seen the film and enjoyed it, his mother said. But she said she struggled to join in the laughter during the screening. "It took me right back to that time, and sometimes that made it difficult to laugh." But a smile, yes. Maybe I can smile about it sometimes.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
One of the things that we need to do on the occasions that we remember Ali ibn Abi Talib salawatullah wa salamuhu alayhi is to look at some of the behavior of Ali ibn Abi Talib salamullah alayhi, to find guidelines for ourselves. We are in need of guidance. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has put him as our imam. An imam is someone who leads. Ali ibn Abi Talib led during his time. Ali ibn Abi Talib's leadership during that time is leading us during our time. Be it that the imam of our time, Ajjalallah ta'ala farajahu sharif wa arwahuna lahu al-fida, is our imam today. However, the words and the conduct of Ali ibn Abi Talib is something that we are told by the imams, by the imam of our time, to look back at, and part of the imama of the imam of our time is to refer us to the conduct of Ali ibn Abi Talib, that conduct, that behavior, his decisions, his guidelines, his guidance are all various forms of guidance for us, and they lead us today. So we've got to look at some of the things that Ali ibn Abi Talib salawatullah wa salamuhu alayh does during his lifetime for us to learn that that's the right way. Now, we may fail in at times to make those decisions or to make them in the best way we can. We may fail to do so, but at least we can begin to understand what those correct decisions are. Another part of what we have received of how Ali ibn Abi Talib dealt with and acted towards the Holy Prophet, behaved towards the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, is his humility. Ali ibn Abi Talib salawatullah wa salamuhu alayhi, his words are just like the words of the Holy Prophet. They come from the same source. The guidance is the same guidance. The Prophet said, Man kuntu mawla, fahada aliyun mawla. The Prophet said, Ana madinatul ilm wa aliyun babuha, faman arada al, or whoever wants the knowledge, فَلْيَأْتِهَا مِنْ بَابِهَا. The door to the knowledge of the Prophet is Ali ibn Abi Talib. So whatever he says is the knowledge of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. This is clear, isn't it? This is, for us it's clear. Whoever has questions, doubts, they can resolve that. This is very clear to us. But how did Ali ibn Abi Talib behave towards the Prophet? He would sit in the presence of the Prophet as a slave. And he said, these are his words, these are his recorded words, أنا عبد من عبيد محمد. I am one of the slaves of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. The humility of Ali ibn Abi Talib towards the Prophet is such that if we didn't know better with our wrong understandings and our wrong approach, we would actually identify him not as one of the companions of the Prophet, that we would ask, oh, who's this person? So he's just one of the servants or one of the slaves of the Holy Prophet. One who did not speak in the presence of the Prophet. One who, although he had that knowledge, as he says in Khutbah Qasi'ah correctly, we have other indications telling us, he saw what the Prophet saw and he heard what the Prophet heard at the cave of Hira on that night. He heard that. Yet he never spoke about what he knew and present that. He didn't. He said, let's see what the Prophet says. Ask the Prophet. He would ask the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. Amir al-Mu'mineen salawatullah wa salam alayhi, his tawadu' towards the Holy Prophet is something we need to learn from, brothers and sisters. Tawadu' Tawadu' in essence means to lower oneself. We need to lower ourselves before the Qur'an. We need to lower ourselves before the Prophet. We need to lower ourselves before the Ahlul Bayt salamullah alayhim ajma'in. One of the reasons why not only we doubt, sometimes one of the big problems that we have, we talked just earlier, the first point we mentioned was not to even have doubt regarding what the Quran and the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt say being true and being from Allah and being guidance, being absolutely 110% true. One of the big problems we have is that some of the members of our so-called Muslim community not only doubt that, they argue against it. We have Muslimin arguing against hijab. We have Muslimin arguing against the approach Islam has towards LGBTQ. We have Muslimin arguing against Islamic government. We have Muslimin arguing against the various laws of Islam. They say, oh, this isn't right. This can't be true. They laugh at it. Like, oh. And then they say, we respect Islam. This is for back then. It was good. It was justified for back then. What gives a person the audacity to stand and say such words? Arrogance. Arrogance, same way Iblis. Iblis was in a condition where everything was visible and clear, what he did, his disobedience of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The audacity to say, no, I will not bow, I will not prostrate, because I am better. These so-called Muslimin that argue against Islamic teachings, they're so proud of their stupidity and so ignorant of their stupidity and so ignorant of their ignorance that they proudly say these things, and we still see them as Muslimin. It's because that setup that Iblis had was very evident. God directly said, prostrate. Everyone, all the angels prostrated. Iblis didn't. There's no question there. Here, we have a Quran that was revealed 1400 years ago. We have an imam that is in ghaibah, in occultation. And so the person who says these things can still claim, unfortunately, that I am Muslim. What causes a person to come to a point where they have the audacity? That what causes that is that they don't have tawadhu. They don't lower themselves. They have this arrogance about what their findings, their thoughts are.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Spyware made by the Zionist regime's notorious NSO group was used to hack the phones of six Palestinian human rights defenders, according to a report published recently. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Maureen Claire Morphy, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Zionist Regime Spyware Targeted Palestinian Human Rights Workers. Stay tuned for more. Spyware made by the Zionist regime notorious NSO group was used to hack the phones of six Palestinian human rights defenders, according to a report published recently. Three of the six targeted groups, including Al-Haq, Adamir, and Defense for Children International Palestine, have cooperated closely with the International Criminal Court investigation into war crimes in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip by the Zionist regime. The Israeli regime seeks to sabotage that probe and consolidate decades of impunity. The fake regime of Israel accused the targeted groups of serving as arms of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a leftist political party and resistance group banned by Tel Aviv, Washington, and Brussels. The Zionist regime has not produced evidence supporting its claims. A 74-page secret Israeli regime dossier purportedly proving its case relies on the testimony of two former employees of a seventh Palestinian organization outlawed earlier in the year who are currently in the Israeli regime detention. The Zionist regime likely obtained their testimony under coercion that may amount to torture. Ireland's government, which funds two of the banned groups, dismissed the dossier as containing no credible evidence. International condemnation and skepticism did not, however, prevent the terror designation under the domestic Israeli regime law from being extended by military order to the West Bank, where the organizations are based. The use of NSO Group's Pegasus spyware against Palestinian human rights defenders was revealed by Frontline Defenders, a group based in Ireland. Adam Shapiro, a spokesperson for Frontline Defenders, told the New York Times that the investigation did not definitively prove who used the spyware, but it raises a lot of questions as to the role not only of NSO but also of the Zionist regime. Frontline Defenders stated that the timing of the terror designation's blacklisting Palestinian human rights groups suggests that it is also an effort to legitimate the surveillance of their staff. The Israeli designation of these organizations as terrorists after Pegasus was detected, but just days before this investigation is reported, appears to be a clear effort to cover its actions and disconnected from any evidence that would discredit these organizations, the Irish group said. Frontline Defenders was contacted by Al-Haq in mid-October about the device of Al-Quds-based staff member and a possible infection with spyware, according to the report published recently. After determining that the device had been infected by NSO Group spyware in July 2020, Frontline Defenders began investigating the devices belonging to the staff of other organizations newly designated as terror groups. They found that five additional devices were hacked with the same spyware. Citizen Lab, based at the University of Toronto, and Amnesty International Security Lab confirmed with high confidence that the phones were hacked with Pegasus, Frontline Defenders said. Pegasus is the name of the spyware made by NSO Group. The hacked devices belong to Qassan Halaika, a field researcher with Al-Haq, Obey Al-Aboudi, director of Bissan Center for Research and Development and a U.S. citizen, and Salah Hamouri, a lawyer with Adamir, who the Israeli regime seeks to deport to France for breach of allegiance to Israeli regime. The three other targeted persons remain anonymous. The U.S. Commerce Department blacklisted NSO Group and Candiro, another Israeli regime company, last week. The sanctions barred the companies from buying parts and components from U.S. companies without a special license. NSO Group in particular has come under increased scrutiny with every new report revealing the extent to which its spyware has been used to target journalists and human rights defenders around the world. The Pegasus spyware can be installed remotely on a targeted person's smartphone without requiring them to take any action, such as clicking on a link or answering a call. Most notoriously, the use of Pegasus was linked to the 2018 murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi inside Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul. Democracy for the Arab World Now recently called on the U.S. to investigate the hacking of the phones of the Palestinian human rights defenders and impose sanctions on those found to be responsible. Four Democratic House lawmakers are also calling for sanctions on NSO Group, arguing that the Commerce Department designation would still allow U.S. investments funds to finance the company. When U.S. investors prop up companies like NSO Group, this implies the asset of the U.S. government, encouraging such companies to continue providing dangerous tools like Pegasus to the most repressive governments, the lawmakers state in a letter to senior administration officials. Meanwhile, a federal judge recently denied a motion by NSO Group to dismiss a lawsuit filed by WhatsApp and its parent company Facebook, now rebranded as Meta, over the targeting of 1,400 of its users with Pegasus spyware over 2 weeks in 2019. NSO Group claimed that it was entitled to foreign sovereign immunity, a protection afforded to government officials even though it is a private company. John Scott Railton, a researcher with Citizen Lab, said that this lawsuit, going forwards, is a massive blow to NSO. The recent revelations of the use of NSO Group's Pegasus software to spy on Palestinian human rights defenders marked a convergence of what had previously been two separate diplomatic issues for the Israeli regime, as noted by the New York Times. NSO Group exports its spyware under licenses from Israeli regime's War Ministry, which issued the order designating six Palestinian human rights groups as terrorist organizations. The Times noted that, according to the Israeli regime policy, Pegasus cannot be used by a foreign government against Israeli regime phone numbers, such as those belonging to the Palestinians in the outlawed groups. The publication added that an Israeli regime agency, however, would have the authority to use the software against an Israeli number. The new military order outlawing the Palestinian groups in the West Bank puts the organization's staff members and their property at imminent risk of raid, arrest, and reprisals, according to Al-Haq. The military order is wide in scope and may be used to target broad swathes of Palestinian society, including witnesses to and survivors of war crimes. The order states that every member of Al-Haq, whether he is incorporated, associated with it or not, whether he operates on the internet or in another way, and every group, cell, and faction, institution, central branch, or faction thereof, is an illegal organization in the meaning of the defense regulations. Al-Haq said that the military order is based on British Mandate-era emergency regulations that were repealed shortly before the end of the mandate and therefore no longer apply. According to Al-Haq, the Zionist regime has repeatedly resurrected the repeated British Mandate order dating from 1945 to outlaw any form of peaceful assembly since its military occupation of the West Bank began in 1967. The rights group said that the Israeli regime's culminative campaign of persecution aims at gradually normalizing its inhuman acts of persecution and apartheid towards Palestinian human rights defenders. The Israeli regime is enforcing its threats with total impunity and complete contempt for the strong statements of condemnation from the UN treaty bodies and officials and European states that followed its initial terror designations in October, Al-Haq added. Recently, Al-Haq called on the European Union and third states to remove terrorism clauses as internal conditions placed on donor funding to Palestinian organizations in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The rights group also called for comprehensive trade sanctions against the Israeli regime, emphasizing the need to end the sale or supply of military products to the state.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat, or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
Our magnanimous Imam, rahmatullah alayhi, changed the direction with Iran, thus bringing about a profound transformation. He changed the path of the Iranian people. He changed the trajectory we were on, and he moved us towards lofty goals. These goals, which guided us with the help of the Imam of the Revolution, rahmatullah alayhi, and that guided the Iranian society towards the revolution, were extremely important. The sum of all these goals is the authority of God's religion. The authority of God's religion calls for social justice in the real sense of the word. It calls for uprooting poverty, ignorance, and oppression. It calls for preparing a collection of Islamic values. It calls for uprooting social detriments. It calls for providing physical, moral, and spiritual health and scientific progress for the country. It calls for offering national dignity, national and Iranian identity, and international power. It calls upon man to activate the capacities that God has given this land. All these terms are included in the authority of God's religion. It was Imam Rahmatullah Alayh who moved us towards this path. This is the exact opposite of the path towards which we were being dragged during the time of Taghut, the Pahlavi era.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
These goals towards which the train of the Islamic community moved, thanks to the revolution, are special goals that are difficult to attain. They take time, they require the passage of time, and they require endeavor. However, attaining all these goals is possible under one condition. The condition that the train should keep moving on this special track, the track of the revolution. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi showed us the way. He showed us the standards and the criteria. He identified the goals for us. He himself began the movement.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.